I'm Manila Chan. You are tuned into Modus Operandi. With the U.S. putting one eye on Ukraine and the other on Taiwan, leadership across the Middle East seemed to have made inroads toward peace. Between Syria being welcomed back to the Arab League and Saudi Arabia's detente with Iran, are we witnessing the birth of a new Mideast sans the Americans? We'll discuss it. All right, let's get into the MO. After more than a decade removed from the bloc, Syria has made its return to the Arab League. After nearly 10 years of civil war and conflicts against terror groups, Bashar al-Assad made his first trip to join the League summit, this year held in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Sometimes called the League of Arab States, the League boasts 22 nations in what's considered the Arab world, countries whose main language is Arabic. Now combined, that's roughly 13 million square kilometers with around 500 million people. The 2023 catastrophic earthquake along the Turkey-Syria border seemed to help much of the League put their differences aside to bring aid to a heavily sanctioned Syria. Now, to be clear, the majority of sanctions on Syria are imposed by the U.S. and collective West. Arab League members, where possible, ignored U.S. pressure and sent aid to those devastated areas of sanctioned Syria. As if that weren't surprising enough, seemingly out of the blue, the biggest kid on the block, Saudi Arabia, emerged saying they have agreed to reestablish diplomatic ties with Iran. The kicker, China brokering the detente. Now, this news put the U.S. on its back foot, scrambling to reassess its foreign policy projections. So joining us to discuss all of these moving parts in the region is Kavork Almasian. He's an award-winning Middle East commentator, founder of Syriana Analysis, an independent Syrian news platform. Kavork, thank you so much for joining us. Let's start with Syria. So after more than a decade, Syria has returned to the Arab League. President Bashar al-Assad arrived in Jeddah on March 18th to a warm reception from the host country, Saudi Arabia. So first, Kavork, walk us through how or why Syria was ejected or at least suspended from the bloc of which they were a founding member in the first place.
Actually, in 2011, the Arab League came under heavy influence of Qatar. And this tiny country, but rich with resources, especially with gas and oil, it was tasked by the United States to shape the outcome of the Arab Spring, especially in, for example, in Tunisia, in Libya, in Egypt, and in Syria. And if we see the sequence of the events, we see that there are some similarities between them, and that Qatar and Turkey, they played an instrumental role in supporting the Muslim Brotherhood groups in these countries. And hence, the Muslim Brotherhood came to power, for example, in Tunisia 2011, in Egypt in 2011, and also the killing of Muammar Gaddafi, again in 2011, after a NATO-led invasion of the country. But on the ground, the groups that were waging the war against the Gaddafi forces, they were mostly from the Muslim Brotherhood as well. So in 2011, there was a trend of, in Arabic we say, Ikhwanization of the Middle East and North Africa. And Qatar was in charge of the Arab League, and they wanted, by kicking out or suspending the membership of Syria, to isolate Syria diplomatically and especially in the region, and also to give legitimacy to any escalatory steps by the United States in Syria that could come in the form of arming and training and sending, for example, multinational jihadists to Syria. Similarly, a similar thing happened, for example, in Libya, and the Arab League gave a legitimacy to the invasion of NATO into Libya. And this was back then headed by Qatar, as I mentioned. So when the suspension happened, there was a hope that Syria would be isolated from its neighboring countries and then give a push to the U.S.-led regime change war in Syria, which was a CIA covert operation. And now we know lots of details about it. It is called Timber Sycamore, and it was one of the costliest covert operation in the history of the CIA, and the costliest I would say, arming and training operation by the CIA and the Pentagon and the United States and the regional countries after the Afghanistan war in the 80s. In the 80s, the United States used similar strategy, which is arming and supporting the Mujahideen, and encouraged lots of young Arabs to go and fight against the Soviet Union. And in 2011, the strategy was the same in Syria. And we have to remember that the first, for example, foreign legion made up of hardcore jihadists was formed in November 2011 in Syria with the support of these regional countries. So the decision was very political, and it was aimed at weakening Syria's position in the region in order to facilitate the removal of Bashar al-Assad from power. But between 2011 and 2013, there were so many developments in the region, and the Saudis, the Emiratis, and some other countries, they realized that the outcome of this regime change wars that they initially supported in 2011 was not in their interests. And they have differences with the Muslim Brotherhood, the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood, but they also realized that by allowing the Muslim Brotherhood to come to power in different countries in the region, Turkey has increased its influence over the region, because Erdogan is also, or Erdogan's party is also an affiliate for the Muslim Brotherhood. And this is historically a red line for the Saudis. We have to remember, for example, during the era of the Ottoman Empire, the Ottomans expanded in the Levant and in North Africa through the gate of Syria. And they found themselves in a similar situation when Erdogan started to speak about the new Ottoman dream and his goal to establish a new Ottoman Empire in the region, and that he is eyeing on different countries and his Arabic countries, and he's going to occupy it. And this is against the national security interests of Saudi Arabia. So they worked during this time to topple, for example, Mohamed Morsi, the president in Egypt. And also they changed the system in Tunisia once again. So there was a revolution and counter-revolutions happening during this time. So the Arab League unfortunately played, I would say, a destructive role. And instead of trying to mediate, let's say, between the Arabic countries or between the opposition and the governments, they came under heavy influence of Qatar, but eventually under heavy influence of the United States. And back then, it was the Obama and the Clinton administration who were guiding this, the outcome, I would say, of these revolutions in a way that serves the strategic interests of the United States. But eventually, this project has failed. And today, we can say that today's this Arab summit, Arab League summit in Saudi Arabia in Jeddah, was the last nail in the coffin of the U.S.-led project to Ikhwanize or Islamize the region, and especially after the return of Syria to the Arab League.
Thank you so much for that history. I mean, it's very important for context here, I think. When Syria gained independence from France after the adoption of the Alexandria Protocols in 1944, Syria and Saudi Arabia were among the founders of this Arab League. So the pair do have a long friendly history. Russian-Syria relations go back to about 1970. How did Russia manage this mediation between Riyadh and Damascus?
Actually, the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Syria witnessed several ups and downs in the past decades. Let's remember that the relationships were always okay between the both sides, but in late 70s and early 80s, when Khomeini came to power in Iran, and after him, Saddam Hussein came to power with the support of the CIA in Iraq in order to fight against Khomeini, Iraq and Iran engaged in a large-scale war against each other. And back then, Hafez al-Assad, the father of Bashar, he sided with Iran against Iraq. And back then, Saddam Hussein was financed by the Americans, the Saudis, and other Gulf monarchies. So there was a big rift between the Syrians and the Saudis, let's say, in the 80s. But in early 90s, when the Soviet Union collapsed, Syria found itself in a position that it doesn't have a strategic ally or an international power that can back Syria on the international scene. So when Saddam Hussein this time invaded Kuwait, Syria sided with Kuwait, with Saudi Arabia, with the United States against Saddam Hussein, and the relationships have been repaired again with Saudi Arabia. And the Saudis invested a lot in Syria because in the early 90s, Syria was going through a very dire economic situation, not similar to now, but it was very bad in the 90s again. So the relationships were repaired again. Till, I would say, 2005, it was okay. In 2005, the assassination of the former prime minister of Lebanon, Rafiq al-Hariri, came, and the Americans and the Israelis accused Syria of assassinating him. And now in 2023, they don't have any evidence for it. But despite that, the accusations were very political against Syria. So the relationships were always ups and down. And then the Arab Spring came, and Saudi Arabia, at the beginning, they were hesitant in joining the regime change war against Syria. But in late 2012, they joined the regime change efforts against Syria. And let's remember what happened in 2013. Bandar bin Sultan came as the head of the Saudi intelligence. And Bandar bin Sultan is he has a very close ties to the neocons in Washington, D.C. He was the ambassador of Saudi Arabia in the United States for a very long time. He was the ambassador of the Saudis in the United States when the 9/11 attacks happened. And now, since we have new information about two of the hijackers who were most probably, they were assets for the Saudi intelligence and the CIA as well, of course, without them knowing that they are assets. Now, probably we can draw links about the this person who has a mastermind in waging false flag attacks, terrorist attacks here and there. And Bandar bin Sultan asked, he called the Arabic foreign ministers, defense ministers, head of intelligence apparatuses, and he asked them to allocate $2 trillion to remove Bashar al-Assad from power. And this was confessed by the former foreign minister of Qatar, Sheikh Hamad bin Jassim, who confessed that on a national Qatari TV and said that Bandar bin Sultan asked this number. Of course, they couldn't gather $2 trillion, but the amount was, in my estimates, at least $200 billion. And if we compare the size of Syria with the size of Ukraine and the amount of support Ukraine is getting now, for example, 130 billion, and in Syria, 200 billion, and the size of Syria is very small compared to Ukraine, I would say the amount of support that the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks gave to these radical jihadists in Syria are probably 5 to 6 times more than the current support that the Americans and the NATO allies are giving to the Zelensky, his forces, and the neo-Nazi battalions in Ukraine. So it was huge support, I would say. Yes, now there is... the circumstances have changed. There are also leadership changes in different Arabic countries and in Saudi Arabia. I would say Mohammed bin Salman, at his first 2 to 3 years, he was more of a war hawk, and he was involved in several military engagements in the region, in Yemen, and he was threatening Iran, and he was bulldogging against Iran. And now it seems that himself, Mohammed bin Salman, changed his attitude. And it's very welcoming because Saudi Arabia is a powerful country, and the amount of military, economic, and religious power that Saudi Arabia have, if it is used for development projects in the region could boom in a way that is unprecedented. And the Middle East could turn into a new Western Europe. And I'm not exaggerating about that, because the amount of wealth that Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and other countries have in the region, if it's invested well, and it seems that they are determined to do so now after the reconciliations with Syria and Iran and other countries, I'm very optimistic, and I'm very happy to see that Arabic countries and Arab leaders are showing different attitude, not only towards Syria, but toward the entire region, because this will reflect positively on the people. Imagine the money that they used for destroying Syria. I'm speaking about at least $200 billion for development projects in Syria. and for finding jobs. And I would say that Syria would have been now similar to Dubai and Abu Dhabi and other more developed countries in the region who are witnessing a strong boom in their economic strength, but also in their infrastructure, in their security. And I would say nowadays, Dubai and Saudi Arabia are safer, and the social welfare and economic welfare there are way better than in Western Europe, for example.
Coming up next, the dragon appears in the desert. China dropping surprise news that caught the U.S. off guard. We'll discuss it when we return with Kevork Almasi, and sit tight. The MO will be right back.
Hi, I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm here to plead with you, whatever you do, do not watch my new show. Seriously, why watch something that's so different? Why listen to opinions that you won't get anywhere else? Look, if it pleases you to have the State Department, the CIA, weapons makers, multi-billion dollar corporations choose your facts for you, go ahead. Why change? And whatever you do, don't watch my show. Stay mainstream, because I'm probably going to make you uncomfortable. My show is called Direct Impact. But again, you probably don't want to watch it, because it might just change the way you think.
Welcome back to the MO. I'm Manila Chan. People often forget that the Middle East region is actually a part of the Asian continent. As such, it should come as no surprise when the biggest country in Asia steps in to mediate a dispute. We're talking about China brokering détente between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Kevork Almasian is back with us. Thank you so much for sticking around, Kevork. So perhaps one of the bigger surprises out of the Middle East lately was the détente between the Saudis and Iran that was brokered by China. Given the years of what many would describe as proxy wars between the two countries and various theaters in the region, the severed diplomatic ties, why is there a revived bilateral relationship between Saudi Arabia and Iran right now specifically? And how did China end up the broker?
Actually, nobody saw that this deal is coming. And we haven't heard about negotiations between the Saudis and the Iranians with the mediation of China. It was a surprise. We were all caught in surprise, and it's a very happy news. And I would say there are different factors in this. Number one, the Americans are, after the withdrawal from Afghanistan and completely focusing on Ukraine and Taiwan, they haven't abandoned the Middle East, but their strength, they are very overstretched now, right now. And if we see the cycle of any empires, the United States is living its last third of this cycle. So it's living its last third of its empire period. And they have to prioritize their political, diplomatic, economic, and military capabilities around the world. So the moment the Americans... we say in Arabic, they pulled their hands from the region. There are other powers who came and trying to fill the vacuum. And China is representing itself as a power that can broker deals, security deals, and diplomatic deals, and economic deals with these strong regional powers. But also, China is presenting incentives for them to make peace, because the Americans, for decades, they were using the divide and conquer strategy and turning neighbors against each other because it was beneficiary for them, financially beneficiary. And now when we say, when I mentioned the United States, I specifically mean the military industrial complex, and those are in the hands of a few tiny elites in the United States. So the United States as an economy, as a people, they're not benefiting from these proxy wars or direct wars that are triggered by the United States. It's the only these tiny elites benefiting from it. However, China is giving incentives to these countries. It is showing them there is a possibility for economic integration between the Chinese economy and these regional powers, and it has presented its, for example, Silk and Road Initiative, and how this Silk and Road Initiative can reflect on the economic welfare of the people, and when different regional countries engage in economic integration, the chances for military conflicts between them also diminish. And this is a concept that China is presenting in the region, and I think it's very welcomed. And because the interest of China is in establishing peace in the region, and the interest of the United States is to keep the region in constant turmoil. So there are two different approaches, and both China, of course, it's becoming more hegemon in the region, and the United States also wants to stay hegemon in the region, but the approaches are different. And I think because the Saudis have a vision now, and their economic vision, and they're preparing themselves for the era, post-oil era, and they want to establish an economic hub in Saudi Arabia, create industrial cities, create technological cities in Saudi Arabia. One of the examples that I heard recently, that Saudi Arabia is building a city attracting, it's a technological city, and attracting software developers and game developers to come to Saudi Arabia and develop online games. And people may underestimate this, but the future, and if we see where are we heading to into the digital world, this could be a main hub in the region for software development and also for gaming development, for example, which will enrich Saudi Arabia a lot. And this is a concept of Mohammed bin Salman, that oil is important, but not using the oil in development projects is a passive thing to do, which Saudi Arabia did for a long time, instead of creating these industrial cities and the technological cities. They were investing their money in wars. They're investing it in creating Wahhabi schools abroad. They're using it for proxy wars here and there. And now they have a different incentive. And I think the mentality plays an important role here. And it comes all to MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, whether you like him or you hate him, that doesn't matter. But he is doing what's in the best interest of Saudi Arabia at the moment, and also for the regional development, in my opinion.
Lastly, staying with Syria, after that botched U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, many thought the U.S. might finally withdraw troops from Syria's eastern region, where both the oil and wheat fields are. What do you foresee happening there? Are they going to leave anytime soon?
The U.S. occupation forces are in Syria to first steal the oil, sell it to the black market in Turkey, and finance their presence in Syria, and also the proxy forces that they train. They're around 50 to 60,000. They call them the Syrian Democratic Forces. They want to keep the oil and the wheat away from Damascus, so the food and the energy. Energy is very important for reconstructing Syria. They want to hold that card for themselves and bargain it, probably in some other strategic file. And the wheat is it's a food war. So there is an energy and food war against Syria as well. In my opinion, when Trump came to power, he wanted to withdraw, and he was serious about his intention to withdraw. But the Pentagon and the CIA went against him, and they told him this is a red line, because they cannot withdraw, from their perspective, from Syria before achieving striking certain deal with Damascus. And up until this moment, Damascus refuses to give concessions to the United States, because in Damascus, they, in their understanding of international politics, that things are changing in the region and in on the global level, especially after the Ukraine war, and with the increasing pace of the process for heading toward the multipolar world, Syria is finding itself in a position that if they give concessions to the United States, there will be a time sooner or later that the United States will lose its grip in all cases over the region. So why would they give a concession to the United States now and lose twice? And so there is this argument in Damascus that the day is going to come after the withdrawal of the Turkish occupation forces from Syria that the United States will be cornered, that the Turks don't want them there because they're training Kurdish militias. The Syrians don't want them there. And now the Saudis saying all foreign forces should withdraw from the region. So at least diplomatically speaking, they will be isolated. And it's the mission is not sustainable because they have 900 troops there. It's not like they have 9,000 troops. They don't have advanced air defense systems. So Syria, up until this moment, they didn't engage in hostilities, like direct hostilities against the U.S. occupation forces. But if there is a military effort against the U.S. occupation forces, then U.S. needs to bring its air force, needs to bring its boots underground, and it's a very costly operation, and they don't want to do that. So I don't see the United States has a future in Syria. They will withdraw sooner or later, and we can use the statement of the former U.S. ambassador to Syria, Robert Ford, as an evidence for that, that he said, we're going to withdraw from Syria. It's better for the Kurds to strike a deal with Damascus before we withdraw and leaving them behind and abandoning them, just like we did with our allies in Afghanistan. So in my opinion, the priority of Damascus should be reconciling with the Kurds in the eastern shore of the Euphrates, striking a deal with them, giving them cultural rights, allowing them to teach Kurdish in their schools and speaking Kurdish in their communities. And it's allowed to speak Kurdish, but the official language of Syria is Arabic. And if you go to, for example, any official center or offices, you have to speak Arabic, not Kurdish. Every country has its different components. We do not divide countries on ethnic and religious basis. Federalism in, I would say, in countries that were divided, for example, like in Germany, which was divided east and west, they were allies, the communists were here, it was very fragmented. Federalism combines the fragmentation. But when you have a unified country, you do not federalize it and try to divide it into different pieces. This is just my opinion.
Kavork Almasyan, award-winning Middle East commentator, founder of Syriana Analysis. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
All right, so there you have it. It seems like when the U.S. leaves so-called feuding countries alone, a lot of good can happen in that vacuum, despite mainstream media parroting State Department talking points that the U.S. must act as the world's police, because others might argue they're less police and more instigator. That's going to do it for this episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy and current affairs. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you again next time to figure out the MO.